This program is sponsored by the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents for a decisive battles discussion by author Donald Miller on his book entitled Vicksburg, Grant's Campaign That Broke the Confederacy. I'm your host, Rob Havers, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago and is sponsored by members of the Museum and Library. This program and hundreds more covering a full range of military topics is available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. In 1861, Ulysses S. Grant was a seemingly washed-up veteran of the Mexican War who had left the Army with the sin of intemperance over his head. The Civil War offered him a shot at redemption. He immediately volunteered and went on to have success at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson before facing criticism following the Battle of Shiloh. Tasked with taking Vicksburg, the last remaining rebel stronghold on the Mississippi, Grant was aided by the ironclad gunboats of the Union Navy in the largest amphibious assault of the war. He spent 9 months trying and failing to subdue the River Bastion, nearly losing his command in the process. In this history-changing campaign, a battle against a hostile environment, as well as a resolute enemy, nearly 100,000 slaves liberated themselves. Of the 100,000 that made it across Union lines for protection, more than a quarter became Union soldiers. In the end, Grant's 47-day siege and bombardment forced Vicksburg into submission. The victory, which came one day after the Battle of Gettysburg, elevated Grant to command of all Union armies. His new command took him east to battle Robert E. Lee, while his Vicksburg army, under the command of General William T. Sherman, swept devastatingly across the Lower South, fighting an unrelenting war that had begun in Mississippi. Donald L. Miller is the John Henry McCracken Professor of History Emeritus at Lafayette College and author of 10 books, including Masters of the Air, which is currently being made into a television series by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. He has hosted, co-produced, or served as historical consultant for more than 30 television documentaries and has written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, and other publications. In a recent review of this work in the Wall Street Journal, the reviewer commented that books like Vicksburg are exactly what Thomas Hardy had in mind when he wrote that war makes rattling good history. Please join me in welcoming Donald Miller to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.
Good evening. It's great to be here. As you can see, I'm a little hoarse, have a cold, and it's great to be back in Chicago. Years ago, I did a book, A History of Chicago, called City of the Century, and we made it into a PBS series and had a lot of success with it. And I've never had a project where the community chipped in more and participated more in the effort. And this place has always been first in my heart, really. It's my favorite American city. This Vicksburg campaign, too, is really a Chicago thing. 36,000 Chicago and Illinois boys fought at Vicksburg. And the largest monument on the battlefield is the Illinois Monument. And it was built by William LeBaron Jenney, who built the first steel frame skyscraper in the world, the Home Insurance Building here in Chicago. He was Sherman's kind of chief of staff, but also his chief engineer. So now this, as Rob said, this is my 10th book, but it's my first book on the Civil War. So I'm a trespasser. I'm moving into strange terrain. And as other historians know, they're always looking for you out there, looking for the mistakes. But I had a lot of help. I had a lot of help on the way. And it was also a book that has had an intermittent career. I started it in the late 90s and then stopped work on it just as I was ready to begin the actual writing process. I had already done research, 51 archives at that point, from California all the way to North Carolina. And but my father had passed away, World War II veteran of the 8th Air Force, and I turned to other books. I turned to World War II books, and the culminating one of those books was the one that Rob mentioned, Masters of the Air. I came back to this project until 2013. And what brought me back was the letters that I had unearthed in all those archives. Uncensored letters, of course, since they're Civil War letters, but fantastically interesting letters. And I also, Vicksburg had a transfixing impact on me. I mean, there's this small city, citadel city, sitting on top of the Mississippi, on these hillsides on the Mississippi River. You got the mile wide, you know, great muddy out there. You got this mysterious Heart of Darkness type swamp, the Delta Swamp to the north. It's interesting terrain. And it's a city, too, that actually voted against secession. And the commander at Vicksburg during the battle is from Philadelphia. He was living in Norfolk when the war broke out. His wife was born there, and she urged him, more than that, actually, to hand in his Union uniform and take on the Confederate gray. And strangely, during the middle of the war, Jefferson Davis sent him, without credentials, I thought, out to Vicksburg to defend it. So it has a lot of interesting sidelights and trips and things like that. And I'm, in the book too, it interested me because when I got into the Vicksburg campaign, my first real encounter with it was watching Ken Burns' series on the Civil War, which I thought was absolutely magnificent. But I didn't care for the section on Vicksburg. He kind of passed it over very quickly and didn't see it, you know, as a decisive battle. I later asked him about that, and he said, well, I didn't have the imagery. I didn't have enough pictures to carry the story. And in documentary filmmaking, the pictures are what really matters. But I sensed, he said, that this was, you know, a history-turning battle, but just couldn't deal with it that way. But an author can. And I was also interested in the scope of this thing. It's not a battle. It's not the Battle of Vicksburg. It's the Vicksburg campaign. And that's how Grant fought and won the Civil War. He didn't fight wars like they were fought in the East. Antietam, Long Low. Vicksburg, Long Low. Before that, Chancellorsville, Long Low. Grant's idea of warfare was relentless resolve. Press the enemy incessantly, and press the enemy with coordinated attacks across broad fronts, akin to Eisenhower's campaign in Europe from D-Day to the Elbe. Yes, there's battles like the Hürtgen Forest and Bastogne and other places, but it's the campaign that matters, the unification of two armies and the crushing of Germany. And I think, you know, that's one of the most important things to think about when you think of this battle. So I was taking on a battle that has tremendous scope. It's 1,200 miles from Cairo, Illinois, where Grant got started, all the way down to New Orleans. And the battle stretches out this way, east to west, for about 70 miles. I rented a boat. I went into the Yazoo Delta. I rented a Jeep, explored just about every place Grant was, I was. And rented a room in Vicksburg and spent an enormous amount of time there. And I think it was that field work, as much as the archival work, that most excited me. And I think that excitement, I hope, comes through in the book. Because I write the kind of books that I hope appeal to scholars. I've got my 170 pages of documentary material. You can outthink me. You can outwrite me. But you have a hell of a time out researching me. But I try not to let the research interfere with the narrative, because I believe strongly that history is all about storytelling. I have a friend in the audience, Mike Donahue, that I went to graduate school with. And as Mike will attest, in graduate school, all we got was historiography. what this historian and that historian said about a battle rather than the battle itself. And I turned away from that early on in my career. When I worked at the Washington Post, I started to become, a pretty good storyteller. And good stories need great stories, make great literature. I think great stories make great history. And Vicksburg is, you know, a can't miss in this regard. This is the battlefield at Vicksburg. Now, this is in the late 19th century, long after 1863. And long before it became, you know, an important national park. But this is Vicksburg several weeks after the battle. And I saw this image early on. A friend of mine down at Vicksburg showed me the image. And I said, my God, that looks like pictures I've seen of Passchendaele in World War I. And this is what siege warfare does to human beings and does to the land. It butchers it. And I want to try to get across that idea as well, because when we walk these beautifully restored battlefields like Gettysburg and Vicksburg, often we don't get a complete sense of the horror of the experience. I also wanted to write, and I'll begin to tell the story in a second, I also wanted to write a book that was different from whatever had been done up to that point on Vicksburg. I wanted to write what I call a social history of the battlefield. In other words, I wanted to include the experiences of people inside the city who were under siege for 47 days. I did a book on bombing in World War II and did a lot of work on the effect of bombing on the psyche of the human beings who are under the bombs. And I think that helped me to understand how the citizens of Vicksburg, mostly women and children, hunkering in caves, survived the trauma and kept their stability and their morale. The morale never faltered throughout the conflict. I wanted to deal with plantation mistresses who, while Vicksburg is being locked up, are out there alone with their overseers on their plantations with as many as 1,000 field hands to manage. And I was able to do that because there are hundreds of diaries, most of them unexplored, that I found in archives in Jacksonville, the capital, and down at Vicksburg, and North Carolina, and Duke, and other places. So I wanted to get into the human element. I wanted to get into medicine and disease, because in the first attempt to take Vicksburg, 40% of the troops either died or incapacitated by withering diseases like measles, smallpox, and most deadly of all, malaria. So disease plays an important part. Women, most of them from Chicago, Jane Hodge, Mary Livermore, two of the, most unknown and yet, you know, and least recognizable but important figures in Chicago history, came down to Vicksburg again and again and brought the troops. They were suffering from scurvy. They brought them lemons. They brought them limes. They brought them fruit. They brought them vegetables. They worked. One of the women, Annie Whitmire from Iowa, she set up 60 hospitals, 60 field hospitals in and out of Vicksburg. She's in and out of the trenches. So women aren't on the perimeter of this battle. They're in the middle of it. They're helping the Union Army, and they're inside the city being bombed, and they're being bombed indiscriminately. There's a lot of myths about the Civil War. One of the reasons it wasn't a total war, historians will tell you, is that civilians weren't fired upon. Well, they were fired upon in Vicksburg. They lived in a circle of fire. When they finally, Grant's army finally traps people inside the city, he puts David Dixon Porter's, Flag Officer David Dixon Porter's gunboats in the river, and he besieges the land side of the city. And you couldn't get a cat out of Vicksburg. And incessantly, day and night, he's throwing an average of 6,000 shells into the city. And the firing is indiscriminate. They don't know what they're firing at. You take a 240-pound mortar shell and fire it from across the river from a giant siege mortar. Goes way up in the sky with its lit fuse. You have no idea where it's going to land. And these things landed, as did shells from Parrott guns and things like that, on hospitals and homes and churches and things like that. And it wasn't entirely accidental. I got into the logs of the gunners, the Union gunners, who write about this at home. They're Christian kids. They're worried about killing civilians. But they're saying this is necessary. It's necessary for us to take the city to defeat the secesh and the abolitionists among them to free the slaves. So I wanted to get into that. And I also wanted to get into the mind of the common soldiers. We know enough about the commanders. I do a lot of that, but I'm also interested in the mind of the common soldiers. And again, having uncensored letters, I'm so used to, I did 3 World War II books and all my letters were uncensored. So I didn't get, they're filtered. And you don't get letters like this. I just remember one letter. A father writes to his son, he's from Iowa, to his boy at Vicksburg. He says, "You come home. You come home this week. Lincoln's just passed an Emancipation Proclamation. You didn't go down there to fight an N war." And the kid writes back and says, "Well, I haven't changed my mind about black people, but I know that everyone we take from them helps us and hurts them, and I'm going to continue to do it." And that's kind of what happened. That's why during the campaign, Grant becomes, through military action, the great emancipator. He frees 110,000 slaves. You don't think of Vicksburg like that. He turns 26,000 male slaves. He puts them into Union Blue, and they fight. They fight for the first time at Vicksburg, not at Fort Wagner, North Carolina, but at Milliken's Bend, defending a supply station that was behind Grant's line. And they fought ferociously, even though they were only given their guns a couple days before. Now, they can't fight efficiently, but they fight heroically and they fight well. And it changed a lot of attitudes in the Union ranks. So you see, I'm taking on a lot in a book like this. If you will, it's a kind of a cultural or social history of a battle rather than a bullet-by-bullet description. So I was a little scared when I started. And when the first time I went down to Vicksburg, I ran into the inimitable Ed Barge. I don't know if you ever seen Ed Barge. Ed Barge is a legendary Park Service guy. And he was head of the U.S. Park Service for years. He was the first park ranger at Vicksburg and later a park ranger at Gettysburg and a Pacific War veteran as well. And he's a crusty old character. He's still around in 95. And Burns, in fact, used him in the Civil War. So I run into Ed Barge. And you don't run into Ed Barge. Ed Barge runs over you, okay? And he found out that I was, that they told him that there's an historian down here nosing around, thinking about doing a book on Vicksburg. That's Ed's terrain. And so he looked me up and he said, "Listen, kid, I'll show you what the battle's all about." So he took me out on a tour of the battlefield. It was thrilling. And he could stand up on top of one of those federal forts and you thought he was a Confederate general commander. You could hear the whistle of the, you know, the bullets flying by your ears. So after the tour, Ed enjoys a pop or two now and then, so do I. We went out for a drink, and Ed leaned into me, very imposing guy, and he said, "Miller, do you know why you're going to write the best book on Vicksburg?" I said, "No, Ed." He says, "Because you don't know a goddamn thing about it." I said, "Well, okay, I'll take that." I said, "That's true, but why then am I going to write the best book?" He said, "Because we're in here in the forest, bumping into the trees, writing the same book again and again." He said, "I've written 3 volumes on Vicksburg and I don't know, maybe 5 dozen articles." And he says, "It's all the minutiae in there." He said, "Luckily, you're coming in fresh and you can see the forest from the trees. And maybe with that perspective, you can bring something new to an understanding of the battle." And he was enormous help to me, as was a guy named Warren Graybaugh, who was down there at the time and knew the battlefield. He was a friend of Ed's, knew it as well as Ed. He'd take me out, 4 more battlefield tours, 3 of them with Graybaugh. And around every curve in the terrain, he's yelling back at me, "Battlefield, battles aren't fought on pool tables. You got to know terrain. You got to know terrain. Pay attention. Pay attention." So I had help. I had help in this struggle. And then finally, the thing that really turned me onto this book and gave me the sense that I could do something different was I read Absalom, Absalom by William Faulkner, published in 1936. The Year Gone with the Wind was published. Very different books, as you can imagine. And one a kind of defense of antebellum culture and one a scorching indictment of it. And I'll just give you one scene from the novel that impressed me. There's an area that I refer to above Vicksburg called the Delta, and it goes from the Yazoo River, 15 miles above Vicksburg, almost up to Memphis. It's about 40 miles wide and extends 80 miles toward Memphis. And it looks like then, certainly to Grant, as an impenetrable swamp. And it's a place that, you know, establishes a certain kind of mood. And I read a statistic that it was by the late 1850s, just before the war, proportion to population, it was the largest cotton-producing area in the world. The United States, India, Egypt, the world. And I read about it, about Vicksburg merchants going in there, or young kids coming out of Virginia families, going in there with their slaves and cutting out of a wilderness, a jungle literally, a plantation civilization, and building it board by board. And by the time the Civil War comes around, they've got a cotton culture, a cotton kingdom, and it was all new. This isn't the world that I found in Gone with the Wind. This is a frontier culture. And I thought, one of the reasons Vicksburgians fought with such tenacity is because it was so new and they had made it. This is their world. And I kept thinking of my Chicago book when I dealt with people like Armour and Field and Swift and in Chicago and Pullman. They were really tough with labor. Labor had no right to have any say in the affairs of capital. We built these, you know, these butcheries. We built this railroad plant. We built this steel plant. We're not going to share ownership by giving you rights over hours and wages and things like that. Well, that's the way Vicksburgians thought about the Yazoo Delta. The Yankees aren't going to take it from them. They had it. And there's a scene in the novel that's terrific. It takes place not in the Delta, but a place just to the north of it, up near Oxford, where, of course, Faulkner sets almost all his novels. And this guy named Thomas Sutpin rides into town. And he has two saddlebags. And that's it. And he's a stranger. Two six-shooters. And behind him are 11 Haitian slaves. Nobody knows who he is. He goes in town, he buys land in a swamp just outside of town. Later on, townspeople go out and observe him. He and his slaves are working in the swamp up to their necks in water, shoulder to shoulder, completely naked. And they're coating their bodies with clay to drive off the mosquitoes. And they're pulling logs out of the bottom of there and clay to use as mortar. And when it's done, when they built their plantation house, it's just a big boarded, eight-room, hollowed-out mansion with no elegance to it at all. It didn't have doorknobs. It didn't have chandeliers. It didn't have silverware. So Sutpin gets his slaves together and gives them a wagon and says, go to the river and buy everything we need to gussy up this place. They come back with chandeliers and carpets and wall hangings and paintings. And he hangs them. And then he goes into town and he gets himself a wife. And he goes back, and all of a sudden, he's a member of the plantation aristocracy of Mississippi. He's a grandee, came from nothing, absolutely nothing. And I thought to myself, he then went to war to defend this with his son. Now, he never ran into Grant, but when he came back from the war, his plantation house was gone, the land was fallow, and all the slaves had disappeared. And guess what? A 5'8", 135-pound kid guy who was a store clerk in 1861 in Galena, Illinois, destroyed his world. And in the process, with his troops, destroyed the whole Cotton Kingdom. And something of recent making, and it was one hell of a fight. So I knew then, too, that I had to have slavery as a more important part of the story than it was, and as a central part of this whole story. Because when Grant went into Mississippi, as I said, he went in as the great liberator. Just one telling anecdote on that point. After they took Vicksburg, Grant, as I mentioned, was friends with a woman named Annie Whitmire, who was a nurse who was very close to Grant's wife, Julia. And she's the one that founded these 60 hospitals. And she rented a house in Vicksburg, and a day or two after the battle, invited Grant to dinner. And Grant went in with some trepidation. And she told the neighbors what was going to happen. And Vicksburg by that time is almost entirely black. The whites have left. And so black people begin to gather around her house when they hear that Grant's coming that evening. And Annie goes out to the front yard, and she talks to one of the elders, and she said, "That man in there isn't your liberator. He's in the White House." And the elder said, no, "That man in there is the one who liberated us." And Frederick Douglass made the same point. He said, "With Lincoln, with the Emancipation Proclamation, freed the slaves, yes, but it couldn't have been possible without military action. And the sword that was wielded by Grant made the document, made the proclamation a reality. And all slaves in the Deep South were freed by military action." People say, why a war? No war. Slavery's still there. Emancipation Proclamation doesn't, until you get the 13th Amendment, Emancipation Proclamation doesn't free a single slave in the North. You're in Delaware when it's passed. You're in Missouri. If you're in an area under Union occupation, you're free. So I wanted to explore that relationship with Grant and how Grant also took black slaves and confiscated Jefferson Davis's plantation and his brother Joseph Davis's plantation, which were just below Vicksburg. He had a dog in this fight. It's his home, it's his home state. How they took those plantations immediately after the war, a week after the battle, and turned them over to black slaves to run entirely as self-sufficient farmers. The same thing Sherman did later on with 40 acres and a mule on the Carolina coast. And Grant said to his military chaplain, Colonel Eaton, who used to run black contraband camps for him, that I want the place to be a Negro paradise. And it was for a time. It could have provided a blueprint for a reconstruction policy that actually gave people, recently enslaved people, a stake in the land and a stake in the country, and maybe eventually and soon the right to vote. But when the war was over, the old owners went to the courts, they reconfiscated the land, and they passed back to the original owners. So that was another story I had hoped to tell in the book. So that's what happened. And let me just begin, we'll take this story, right through to its end, beginning to end, in the last 20 minutes we have here. And let me just begin with this. Say you're there. It's January 7th, July 7th. It's 12:45. You're in the White House. Abraham Lincoln sitting at his desk with a map of Vicksburg on his lap, talking to Salmon Chase, his Secretary of Treasury. And he's in a terrible mood. He was profoundly depressed that morning at a cabinet meeting because George Gordon Meade, the commander of the Army of the Potomac, had stopped Lee at Gettysburg, but then didn't pursue him aggressively, and he got away. And according to Gideon Wells, who was at the meeting, he said Lincoln put out his hand and said, "We had him right there," and just didn't close the deal. And he got back to Virginia, and we have two more years of war. And just at that moment, when he's explaining his feelings to Chase, in comes Gideon Wells from the Navy Department, which is right across the road. And he's jubilant, and he has in his hand a telegraph from Admiral Porter at Vicksburg. And Porter is a grandiose kind of guy, his prose is very rich, and he's a bit of a pontificator. It's a long telegram. But anyway, Wells summed it up. Vicksburg is ours. Lincoln leapt out of his seat, and he was not a man given to contact, and put his arm around Wells. And Wells says this: "He caught my hand, and throwing his arm around me, exclaimed, 'It's great, Mr. Wells, it's great.'" Next day, telegram comes in from Ulysses Grant. It says just this: "The enemy surrendered this morning." And that's Grant, plain as pie. plain as pie, and right to the point. And with this victory, the outcome, before we get into the start, the outcome is the Confederacy split in two. Louisiana, great parts of it, western Louisiana, the richest rice country, is out of the Confederacy. They're cut off. The river, the Mississippi, becomes a Yankee river, finally, from New Orleans to Cairo, Illinois. Arkansas is out of it. Texas is out of it. Texas is really important because a lot of British guns, rifles, came through the blockade through Galveston, Texas. It's going to be hard to communicate with the Western Confederacy for the rest of the war. Grant captures at Vicksburg an entire army. It's the second time in the war that he had done that, okay? And he'd done it at Fort Donelson a little bit earlier. And he captures a lot of supplies as well and deals a terrific morale blow, especially combined with Gettysburg, to the Confederate cause. But the biggest outcome, I think, and I hope I've made a contribution here, is Grant takes the way he won the war, his methodology, his strategy. He takes that east, when he's called east, to fight R.E. Lee in Virginia, when he's made general-in-chief of all U.S. armies, commander-in-chief of every U.S. army. This is the kind of war that he brought to the east. Relentless war, the kind of war I just described before. That's a war of gigantic campaigns, but it's also a war where we're warring on property as well as persons. And we're burning, we're pillaging, such as Phil Sheridan did in the Shenandoah Valley. And we're doing this in a coordinated fashion and without a day of rest. And I think this, it was actually Grant who taught Sherman how to fight. When you talk about Sherman's famous march to the sea, to Savannah, and then through the Carolinas, Sherman learned that from Grant. Grant was a real man of iron here. I mean, Sherman was issued orders against his troops in the Vicksburg campaign early on that if you enter a home, a private home of a Southern citizen, you'll be subjected to hanging. Now, he didn't hang anybody, but it was a dire threat, and it told you what he felt about this sort of thing. He wasn't doing it to respect property. He was doing it because it would cause ill discipline, lack of discipline in his army. And he needed a disciplined, tightly focused army. But that's Sherman, always calling for that. But by the end of the Vicksburg campaign, Vicksburg is in an ironic situation. The longer they hold out inside the city, the more Grant destroys Mississippi and destroys plantation culture outside of it, because there's no army out there to stop them. There's nothing. And by the end of the war, you have the end of slaveocracy in the third largest slave state in the Union. Now, much of my book, almost all of it actually, is about how Grant did this. And he did it in such a way that, well, he makes enormous mistakes along the way. The Grant of 1861 could not have taken the city in that year. He has to learn how to fight. And in learning how to fight, he makes humongous mistakes. And he drinks to excess. And there's a myth around that he never drank when the army was in danger. That's not true. He did. He did on a number of occasions. And I try to document them in the book. He doesn't drink on the battlefield, but he drinks close to it when his army was in peril. So, and there's hard evidence as well for it. So up and down guy. And you got to think, what a guy. Rupp started this out. You know, there he is, Appomattox. Go back to the beginning, to Fort Sumter. Fort Sumter, April 1861. I was saying he's a washed up army captain. He couldn't make it in real estate, couldn't make it in farming. And he has to subject himself to the indignity of going to his father, who had a love-hate relationship, and asking him for a job in a leather goods store in remote Galena. And he went there. And war breaks out, and war made Grant. A couple months later, he's named a brigadier general. He read about it in the paper. No one told him about it. Congressman from his district nominated him, and Lincoln signed it. He didn't even have enough money to buy a uniform when he showed up at Cairo. They didn't know who he was. 1 year later, he takes Fort Donelson, biggest Union victory of the war up till then. Unconditional surrender Grant. That's where he gets the name. Next year, he captures Vicksburg. Next year, he goes east to fight R.E. Lee. Next year, he takes Lee's surrender at Appomattox. 4 years later, he's president of the United States. You couldn't make that up. If I did that as a novel proposal for a piece of fiction and handed it to my editor, he said, "You got to be kidding. This guy's unreal. This is Forrest Gump, not Grant." And so you have these great characters. And so let's, using these slides, I'll run along here. And there's our boy, Ulysses Grant, in Virginia. In Virginia. It's a famous picture. His right-hand man, Sherman. I describe Sherman like this in the book. On the surface, comparing to Grant, they were an incongruent pair. Grant, serene and stable. Sherman, explosive and high-strung. A splendid piece of machinery with all the screws a little loose. But they had much in common. Former failures with soaring ambition. Westerners reaching for significance. And together they viewed the heartland as a pivotal theater of the war. Quote, "The man who at the end of this war holds control of the valley of the Mississippi will be the man," Sherman predicted. Pretty much came out that way. Pretty much came out that way. This is one of the diary-writing Southerners that I describe. She's a tough lady, Kate Stone, and young, well-bred, well-educated. You're reading her diary. It's luminous prose. And then you come to a passage. "Hallelujah for John Wilkes Booth. He killed a tyrant today." And you get a sense of the ardency of Confederate thought. And these are the women behind the men, and they're pushing them hard. There you get a sense of Grant. I want to present a picture of Grant in my book as a river warrior who knew the rivers of the West and exploited them to his advantage. And his troops aren't marching generally here and there. Yes, they do that too. But when they can, they move on rivers and they move quickly. And here's a larger map of the scope of the theater that we're talking about, the Mississippi, all the way up there to Illinois, all the way down to the Gulf, okay? Now, the first attempt to take the city is entirely a Navy effort, and it's spearheaded by Gideon Welles, the Secretary of the Navy, and who hires on for the expedition, who appoints to the expedition, I should say, David Dixon Farragut. An unlikely character. Of course, he'll become famous in the war, you know, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead and all that, Admiral Farragut. But Farragut was an unlikely choice. Like Pemberton, who I mentioned earlier, he was from Norfolk, only he went north with his family and gave up all his contacts with his southern friends. And he was an unlikely person to lead an expedition to, in this case, take New Orleans. This is the Navy's idea of getting a hold of the Mississippi. Come up below it. And like this, his sidekick in this expedition is this guy, Admiral Porter, later Admiral Porter, who will be with Grant, one of the partners in command at Vicksburg. But it also is the foster brother of Farragut. So they're close. And their plan is to come up through the Gulf, past these two forts, Fort Jackson and Fort Phillip. St. Philip took a pounding there in a night battle. So they bypass the forts, they move up the river, and they take New Orleans without a shot. And that's in late April 62. Their object is to move as far up the river as they can. And they're coming up there in seagoing ships, saltwater ships, tough to navigate on the Mississippi, really tough with its serpentine turns and, you know, all the obstructions and the sandbars and things like that. And They bombard the city incessantly. And you can see here Farragut's fleet below the city, and they were joined by that fleet on the left there. That's the gunboat fleet, the Union gunboat fleet, the ironclads. They've come down from Memphis, which they've just conquered. So they've come down all the way from Cairo to Memphis. And Farragut says, "I can't take the city on my own because I can't elevate my guns sufficiently, and I don't have enough army troops. I only have 600. And the army wouldn't cooperate. If the army had cooperated with the Navy, they'd have taken Vicksburg in 62, easily. But Halleck doesn't release his troops in Tennessee. So the Union gunboats come down. They join Farragut. And this is the largest brown water Navy in the history of the world. You don't think of gigantic siege, the largest concentration of naval power in the Civil War in all of North American history. And they bomb the place for 2.5 months. And they're defeated, as I said earlier in the lecture, they're defeated by disease. And when the disease summer really hits with ferocious force in August, the ironclads back down, back up to Memphis, and Porter, you know, goes down with Farragut to New Orleans, and that's the end. At this point, Vicksburg knows they're coming back. They're coming back. So Davis sends out new commanders, John Pemberton, who I mentioned, the Philadelphian, to head the expedition, Joseph Johnston, who a lot of people considered at the beginning of the war the top Confederate general, although he was injured very seriously, wounded very seriously in the battle to defend Richmond when McClellan invaded. So Vicksburg is going to build up its defenses and become the most fortified city on the Mississippi River. See, at this point now, Farragut, when he went took New Orleans, went upriver and took Baton Rouge, took Natchez without a fight, both of them, stood in front of Vicksburg, defiant Vicksburg, refused to surrender, so he pounds him with his guns, and that fails. And the Union gunboats had come all the way down the river and taken every major river port, including Memphis. So the river between Memphis and just below Vicksburg is Confederate. The rest of the river is Union. That's what Grant has to do, open that area of the river and defeat the Confederate army that's holding it. And that's the city itself, 4,200 people. And this is what I've described before, the bombardment. And you see the swamp here, too, just to your right. And that's the Yazoo Delta. That's Vicksburg during that horrible summer. And now from the north, after they pull out, Grant begins his campaign almost at the same time Farragut does. And he begins it from this god-awful place called Cairo, Illinois, which one soldier described as the drinking capital of the world. And Grant partook there. And it looks like a god-awful place, and it is. It's a magnificent mud hole. Charles Dickens wrote about it in 1842. It said, having seen it, I earnestly desire never to see it again. But it becomes the largest military port in the country. Everything that happened inland in the West is fed from Cairo. This place is gigantic by the end of the war. Hospitals, supply centers, troops, nurses, bandages, apples, oranges, cannons, bullets, everything comes from Cairo, because Cairo is connected to right here, Chicago, by the only central railroad. And here's what Grant sets out to do. Right after he's named a brigadier general, reads about it in the paper, he sits down with a friend of his named Emerson, and Emerson sees him sitting out on the front lawn at a bench, and he has a big red crayon, and he's drawing on the red crayon. And what's he doing? He's marking out the rivers that he has to take. He said they're invasion highways into the South. The Mississippi, the Cumberland, the Tennessee. And he said, we can take them because we have gunboats, ironclad gunboats. And it's going to be hard for them to defend against these gunboats. And he takes these gunboats into Kentucky and in the winter and spring of 62. And you know the battles there, the battles of Fort Henry and Donelson, all river campaigns. And down by river to Pittsburgh Landing, which we call Shiloh. And from Shiloh by land onto Corinth, and then into Mississippi. And Grant then invades Mississippi by land from the north, and he gets cut to pieces because they get behind him. He gets all the way to Oxford, Mississippi, where the university is today, was then actually. And they cut his supply line. Sherman had warned him, you have too long a supply line, a railroad all the way back up to Cairo. And Nathan Bedford Forrest attacks in Tennessee. Van Dorn attacks in Mississippi. And Grant has to turn around. But before he turned around, he sent an expedition up to Memphis under Sherman. And they went down the river, all the way down the Mississippi, to Vicksburg, to that place called Chickasaw Bayou you see there. The Confederates were waiting for him. They spotted him. It's a long journey down that river. They were dug in under man, but dug in, and they slaughtered Sherman. And he pulls out of there on New Year's Eve and says to his wife, I've met Vicksburg, and it was too much for us. And that's when Grant comes down. And the rest of my book, really, is about how Grant does it. And I'm not going to go into great detail on it because it's something that's one of the more better known aspects of the campaign. But what he does very simply is this. His problem is, how in the world am I going to get footing to mount a campaign against Vicksburg? He's in camps in Louisiana. There's a mile-long river separating from Vicksburg. If he attacks it frontally, he gets slaughtered. He thought if he ran boats by it, gunboats, they'd get destroyed by Vicksburg's powerful river batteries. His scouts told him if he went into this area, the Yazoo Delta, you can't move an army or a navy through there. He wants to get to dry ground below Vicksburg. He could have marched down the Louisiana side and got below, but how's he going to get the troops across? Second thing was, all of Louisiana was flooded. Entire towns. So for 3 months, which is the Valley Forge of the Civil War, soldiers dying like flies on the levees, their coffins slipping from shallow graves in the levee into the river. Mary Livermore, when she came down from Chicago, she said, I saw dead bodies and open coffins floating in the river because that's where the troops were camped and that's where they were buried. And Grant sends Sherman, and I'll conclude with, he sends Sherman and Porter and five of his gunboats. And this is how desperate he is in March. He's been thwarted three times in March of 1865. He sends them into the Yazoo Delta. And you see that little spot there, Steele's Bayou Expedition. And they're going to go around that bayou and come out on the other side near Jackson and attack Vicksburg from dry ground. They can't get through, though. They get trapped. Porter's with the gunboats ahead of Sherman. Sherman is having a tough time because he has these troop transports, which are nothing more than Mississippi steamers. Notice they're knocking the chimneys and top decks off. The trees are. The canopies of trees hanging over there. He gets to a spot, Porter does, where there's clear water. And just then, 600 rebels jump him. And they're about to board his boats. He hands out rifles to his sailors, said it's going to be toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose, and we're probably going to lose. Smear mud on the sides of the ship so prevent them from boarding. When they board, shoot them on sight. But we're going to lose this thing. And as we're losing, we begin to lose, we're going to blow the boats up and head to the forest. He sends word to Sherman, help. Send it with a slave. Took a slave who knew the countryside, took a piece of tobacco, wrapped a message in tobacco. The kid put it in his hair, and he got to Sherman. Sherman couldn't get through with boats. Took his men off the boats. They marched all night with candles in their rifles and marched all the way to Porter and got there just in the nick of time. Porter's on the deck. Three of his leading officers have been shot, and they're on the deck beside him. Sherman gets there just in time. I submit to you, this is my point. History's contingency. It could have went a different way. We could have lost the Civil War. We could have lost the Battle of Vicksburg. Losing the Battle of Vicksburg could have lost us the Civil War. And Grant, by sending these expeditions in there, could have lost his top commander, his top admiral, and five of his gunboats with which he needed the whole Vicksburg campaign. So that's what we try to do in the rest of the book. Take you from this spot where everything's going wrong, and Lincoln is so angry with Grant that he sends down a spy named Charles Dana. And Dana arrives, and they finally run the batteries, march through southern Louisiana because the water miraculously recedes at that point, just as Grant at the nadir of his career. He marches his army, took him a month to do it, creates a panic migration in Louisiana, then lands on Mississippi soil, and in 18 days defeats five armies, moving from Port Gibson on the southern part of this map, Raymond, Jackson, and a place called Champion Hill, which is Churchill called the most important battle of the Civil War, then a battle right in front of Vicksburg, and then he forces them into a siege situation inside the city, surrounds them like this. This is a siege line. Porter's boats, gunboats are on the Mississippi. He now has a supply line to the north, so guys in the trenches can be relieved every 2 hours because there's more guys coming. He starts with 41,000, Grant does. He winds up with 71. These guys are in two-hour shifts. The Confederates are sleeping on their guns. in withering heat, storms, the works, and they're poorly fed. They're eating mule meat by the end of the campaign. He's got good generals like Logan. And finally, they start to dig their way. This is an aggressive siege toward Vicksburg. This is a map of one of the operations. Sappers digging toward the trenches. They start to blow the trenches up. After this battle, they entered that cavern at the top there, that hole, and 900 men fought for 29 hours in there, nose to nose, to such an extent where they couldn't fire their guns, because if you pointed the gun at somebody, they could just pull the rifle out of his hand. They used guns as harpoons. Guys would hand them up with a bayonet on and fire them like that. Finally, the northern guys, Grant pulls them out of the hole, but Pemberton knows it's over. He knows there's going to be more explosions, more breaks in the siege, and he finally decides to meet with Grant in an open field. I wouldn't have liked to have been at that conversation, but out there while their subordinates work out the terms of surrender, which, as I said, included not the unconditional surrender of the city because the troops were paroled rather than jailed, but this is the turning point. And I would conclude by saying it's a turning point because, and more important than Vicksburg, because than Gettysburg, because Gettysburg is a hallowed ground, a magnificently important battle, but strategically, it's only important if the North had lost. Because Grant gets away, re-spirits his army, regroups his army, and he and Lee are at it again for 17 months in Virginia. A lot more war. In the West, it's over. It's over. And the Mississippi's ours. So that, in brief, is what I try to do. And thank you for your attention.
Where were most of the Union ironclad boats constructed? Were they in Cairo or elsewhere?
Close by. A guy named Eads, E-A-D-S, shipbuilder, later built the railroad bridge over the river at St. Louis. One of the great engineers of the time. Bridge still stands. And Eads took out a contract to build six of the gunboats. They were built at Carondelet. They were built near Cairo, Mound City. And they're called the City Series. They're named after the cities they were built in. So, and they're built right at the beginning of the war. As soon as the war broke out, Eads' friends, there were a lot of Missourians on the cabinet, like Bates, told Lincoln that this guy's a miracle man. He never built a boat before. His job was rescuing wrecked material from the bottom of the Mississippi. Steamboats had sunk, and there was a lot of cargo down there, and he had these salvage boats. But he built these boats in 90 days, and all of a sudden we had a brown water navy. It was an amazing feat, and continued to build more of them. Yeah, but those first six were all Eads boats, and the ones he had in the Delta that I described were Eads' boats.
How did Grant cover Vicksburg in his memoirs, and what did you think of his account?
Well, I think Grant is one of the best writers in the English language. I mean, and I'm including, the whole canon, Emerson, Melville, whatever. And I think he executed a brilliant campaign. He needed resolve. He needed stubbornness. He's always afraid of getting fired. And you see that. That's one thing my book's a lot different from Chernow's biography, because I try to get into those Grant's, the head of the Grant papers, John Simon, who tragically passed away not too long ago, said there's vulnerabilities to Grant when you find them. And he is fearful of being removed on a number of occasions. And when he does, he lies. He lies about casualties. Or he doesn't, or he obfuscates. In one case, the siege was preceded by two suicidal assaults on the Union, on the Confederate line. He got to Vicksburg and he said, "Look, I just defeated them. I chopped them up at Champion Hill, chased them that entire night to the front of Vicksburg, slaughtered them there. They're in the city. We've just arrived. They've just arrived. They have to be tired, vulnerable, and beat up." And he also knew that an army was being sent down, an army of relief by Jefferson Davis. And that army was forming under Joseph Johnson at Jackson. He said, now I got Johnson, who he respected more than any general in the Confederacy. He considered Johnson a better general than Lee. And he got Johnson on his back. So he says, I don't want to get in a siege situation with fighting two armies like this. So he tries to bust through. And he only has one division up, and that's Sherman. And Sherman's men got slaughtered. And the next day, he brings all three of his divisions up, and it's a simultaneous attack by the stopwatch. In a coordinated fashion, they move forward, and they get slaughtered. He forgot that men are a lot braver when they're fighting behind fortifications. And field armies don't have to maneuver and march and make all kinds of difficult military maneuvers in the field. They're a lot better as troops, static troops. We found this out on D-Day, when most of the troops in Omaha Beach, German troops were Easterners with little experience, but fighting behind machine guns in concrete positions, they were pretty effective. 10,000 casualties on Omaha Beach. And that's pretty much happened on these. So, and my point was, when he writes back to Halleck, he says, he has one sentence: we attacked the enemy, casualties were minimal. I think tragically, the kids are left out in the field, the dead, and worse yet, the wounded. And the battlefield stunk so bad, the lines are very close together, Union and Southern lines. And the rebels said, they requested a truce to bury the dead and retrieve the wounded, and Grant refused. And then later on, under pressure from his generals, he agreed to it. But he was such a prideful guy, he didn't want to admit that he'd lost this thing. And I could see the sieges. They make military sense. You'd have to decide whether it's one way or the other. There's an argument there. But there's no argument on the question of his not retrieving those guys. But yet, there's that other Grant, who had this tremendous rapport with his men and sympathy for him, and was casualty averse, actually, on a lot of occasions. When he set up the siege line, he said, we're going to starve them out, and I don't want to take casualties. So I want to build the best defensive positions possible. We're going to hold on here and try to beat them with a minimum of casualties. And that became a rifle battle. But he did also support the bombardment of women and children. He supported that. And I don't see that in most Grant hagiographies rather than biographies. Yeah.
What is your view of the long conflict between McClernand and Grant?
Well, I think Lincoln made a big mistake. John McClernand was a political general from Illinois. And he was a war Democrat and not an abolitionist. And Lincoln needed the support of both the abolitionist Republicans and the war Democrats. He didn't care personally for McClernand, but he gave him a commission and he trusted him. McClernand was a pretty good fighter. He wasn't West Point trained, but he had bulldog tenacity and won a couple battles single-handedly, including Fort Gibson. I don't think Grant gives him credit for that. But anyway, McClernand from the very start was jealous of Grant and tried to undermine him continuously. So Grant, through the entire campaign, has a general on his staff, on his inner staff, in his inner circle, who is writing letters behind his back, back to the White House, out to newspaper letters, claiming falsely that Grant is drinking heavily in certain instances. Once in a while, he was right. More often, he was wrong. He also claimed Grant was incompetent. And he wanted special command. And Lincoln, amazingly, to Lincoln's discredit, Lincoln and Stanton gave McClernand a commission. They told him, take a leave of absence. This is just before Sherman went down the Mississippi. This is late 1862. He gives him a commission, sends him to the Midwest. He raises 50 to 60,000 men and sends them down to Memphis and said, I'll be down to pick you up, and we're going to take Porter's gunboats as escorts, and we're going down the river. And while that's happening, Grant is moving toward Vicksburg by land, in that land campaign. So you got two campaigns going on at the same time. And McClernand doesn't know that Lincoln's marching, that Grant's marching, and Grant doesn't know that McClernand's in this sort of thing. What a mess. And finally, Halleck, this gets very, Byzantine. Halleck, who's general in chief, and had always hated Grant. In fact, had him arrested earlier in the war. He hates McClernand so much because McClernand isn't a West Point trained general. He starts leaking information to Grant saying, hey, there's another expedition coming down. And Grant goes, what? This is my department. No, they're coming. And they're gathering troops at Memphis. Maybe you should go to Memphis. So that's why he sends Sherman to Memphis. He said, go to Memphis, pick up the guys that McClernand sent there, because McClernand is stalling. He's back in Illinois marrying he's a widower, marrying the younger sister of his deceased wife at this huge wedding. And he doesn't even have the sense to contact Porter, who's going to combine with him and protect him with his gunboats, in fact, lead the way. So Porter says, when Sherman contacts him, he said, sure, I'll cooperate with Grant. I'll meet you at Memphis, and we'll hijack those troops. And they did. They just picked them up, all McClernand's men, and they took them to Vicksburg. McClernand got there 7 days later, and there's not a single one of his men on the dock. He's angry beyond belief, writes to Lincoln. You know, he's, I don't know who's to blame for this. It's Halleck. And he goes down and arrives at Vicksburg just as Sherman's pulling out of the swamp after he got slaughtered at Chickasaw Bayou and says, I'm in charge. And Sherman writes to Grant, who's just got polished pretty good in, you know, in Mississippi, and says, you got to come down and because we can't serve under him. Porter doesn't want to serve under him. I don't want to serve under him. It'll be a calamity. And Grant goes downriver and takes over the army and sets up his camps in Louisiana. And that's when he begins these four or five futile navigational and water campaigns to get inside Vicksburg and fails at every one of them. A whole lot of them could have been fired. You know?
What parts of Winfield Scott's plan to invade the South did Grant take for his own use as commander of the armies?
Excellent question. We have no direct evidence that he read the plan, but his strategy is a mirror of the campaign. He didn't. Winfield Scott was getting too old and too heavy. He weighed 340 pounds to be an effective commander-in-chief of the army. So McClellan convinces the president to replace him with him. But his original plan was called the Anacondia Plan. And we're going to squeeze the South like an anacondia. He said, we'll blockade the Atlantic ports, cut off their supplies, and we'll send an expedition down the Mississippi to take all of the federal forts along the Mississippi, as the Union Navy did. And then we'll apply pressure from both sides. They can't get supplies from Texas and the West. They can't get supplies from England in this direction. And squeezing him like an anacondia will take fewer casualties. And he said, and another thing he added in the plan is we'll go down when it is not the disease season, and because that will be killing on us. And Grant's plan is a lot like the anacondia plan, except for the blockade thing. Although Porter was on blockade duty, you know, and Farragut for a lot of the campaign. So that basically is it, yeah. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you to Donald Miller for a great discussion. And thank you to the members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library for sponsoring this program of Pritzker Military Presents. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit us in person or online at pritzkermilitary.org. Thank you. And please join us next time on Pritzker Military Presents.
Be a part of our live studio audience. Explore military history and learn more about our series by visiting PritzkerMilitary.org.
Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.